Jeremy Carlin, Knox County State's Attorney candidate on the Democratic side, joining us here today. And I believe it's been a few months since we've talked to you, Jeremy. So thanks for coming back to share your views and your ideas for the office ahead of the November election.
Thanks for having me back, Cameron.
Yeah. I know in the past you've talked about some strategies for crime prevention in the state's attorney's office as opposed to just reacting to crimes that happened. Can you kind of talk about what that would look like and what your ideas are for that sort of approach?
Sure. I think there's a – historically, you have the state's attorney's office just reacts to a crime that's been, that has occurred. Just like you said, an arrest happens and then they prosecute it. And my approach would be to, instead of simply waiting for the crime and sitting in the courthouse, is to go out into the community and work with churches, schools, law enforcement, whomever – to try to identify those people who are at risk before they get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you wait for them to make it to the state's attorney's office, it's often too late.
Yeah.
Now, sure. I think that if you ask any school teacher, any elementary school teacher right now to identify some of those kids who are at risk in their classrooms, I bet they could give you a pretty good sense of those kids who they have a sense that there might be something going on at home, or there's misbehavior in a classroom, or there's tardies or absences, grades, that we could start working at that point to start working with those kids to figure out what's going on and get them the help they need. What's nice about working that early is that often those children's parents are often kids themselves,
mm-hmm.
practically speaking.
Sure.
And so we could start working with those families. Like now, an example of that kind of approach that we use in Knox County is the Solutions Program through the YMCA,
mm-hmm.
where they're identifying kids who are at risk early and getting them the positive attention that they need. And we know the data on that is spectacular, that you're taking these kids who are identified using criteria of office referrals when we had offices, tardies, GPA, absences. And you take that group and you start working with them. Office referrals went down 75%. Absences went down 75%. The GPA of that group was higher than the school average.
Mm-hmm.
So if we could start using our resources to try to work with people in advance, then you are talking about some real crime prevention.
Are you talking about setting up specific programs, or are you just talking about as you as an individual in the office I guess, finding unique strategies wherever they can be found?
Well, my goal is, I mean, first of all, you know, I don't believe that I have the solutions to all of these things. I think that many of the solutions can be found in the community with the individuals who are there. So if I get people, my goal is to provide the table, you
mm-hmm.
know, and bring the people to the table. And I think working together, we can come up with a solution that makes sense for Knox County and the communities they're in.
I know you have plenty of experience in civil law, and that's something your opponent, Brian Kerr, does not necessarily have. In what ways do you think that experience in civil law can benefit the Knox County State's Attorney?
Well, I think I joke. A State's Attorney once told me that five-thirds of the headache of being a state's attorney is the civil work. Being the state's attorney of Knox County is not just simply prosecuting cases and being involved with crime prevention and prosecution. That's part of the job. The other part of the job, and a really important part of it, is being the chief legal advisor to county officials and to the county board.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to be kind of like the jack of all trades, understanding from labor and employment law to workers' compensation to environmental to any number of eminent domain to any number of issues that will come up before one of these government entities. You need to be able to handle it, and you also need to want to handle it. That's the kind of thing that is easily just kind of pushed to the side. Now, the example that I use for, I think, as a model state's attorney is Paul Mangieri, who I worked for years ago. And what he would do is that he would come to the office early before the courthouse opened, around 7:30. He and I would kind of race each other to the courthouse. And he would have that time set aside for county officials, either department heads or county board members, to come and, you know, ask him questions as they needed. So it was dedicated time before the craziness of the day really started. And in that way, you know, a person could come in and – often he was giving legal opinions written, researched right then and there, and handing it right to them. And I think that's really important. Now, my experience 25 years in the community doing civil work and criminal work puts me in a good position to handle those very legal questions, varied legal questions that the county is going to see.
I know there was definitely some tension between the county board and the state's attorney's office, and you did represent the county board in that dispute. We don't necessarily have to get on into all the specifics right now, but do you feel that there are those tensions resolved, and would there be any sort of, I guess, obvious legal or obvious tension that would remain or that you would have to resolve if you became the state's attorney? That makes sense.
Well, if I became the state's attorney, I don't think I would have those conflicts. Mm-hmm. I represented the county board during the disputes that you're referring to.
Yeah.
And so I believe that I would come to handle the situation in a way that would be diplomatic, that would try to find common ground, and understand that as a department head or as an elected official, yes, I have to be kind of look out for my office.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have to understand that that is a part of a whole county government, and the county board's job is to kind of try to fit all those pieces together. I don't believe I'm going to have any problem whatsoever. Many of the people on the county board right now are are endorsing my campaign. And mm-hmm. so they're looking forward to working with me, starting 2 months from now.
The only thing that I can think of that might put you into dispute with the county board is if you ask them for more money. And is that something that you see happening? I know you have a lot of ambitious ideas for the office. Do you think that you would anticipate requesting the county board for any sort of significant budget increase in the next few years?
I don't believe that I will. I think that with the plans that I have for the office, that we're going to change the way that we do things. We'll by the very nature of trying to get people who commit crimes of addiction or crimes of mental illness out of the court system early. That means we're filing less felonies, that we have fewer pending felonies taking up space in our courtrooms, and so we're going to need fewer resources in the courtroom to deal with those types of cases. We can focus that resources on the most serious cases. Also, that will free up time and manpower and resources to deal with these other goals that I have, to come up with a program to deal with addiction and mental health, to come up with other types of programs that, help people who need help.
Mm-hmm. I know you've mentioned before, and you just mentioned it there, that Knox County charges a good deal felonies, around 800 annually, and Peoria County has less than that despite having a much larger population. I don't know if this is anything – it's probably not something you can quantify, but can you talk about to what if we have 800 felonies now, do you have any idea of how many felonies annually that we would expect under your office? What percentage of those charged are unnecessary, I guess, in your opinion?
Well, let's get a good handle on what the situation is.
Yes.
In Knox County, we're filing between 800 and 900 felonies a year. I think even with COVID, we're at that level. And we're a county of, about 50, 51,000 people.
Yes.
And to give you an example, then Peoria, which is a county of about 180,000 people, files 700 felonies a year. Now, I don't think that the statistics in Knox County bear out that we are three times more felonious per capita than Peoria, a county that had 28 homicides last year.
Yeah.
And so clearly we're doing something different. And in fact, if you take a look at the rate that Knox County files felonies, we're one of the highest – we file felonies at one of the highest rates in the entire state.
Mm.
What does that mean? Now, first of all, what we can do to reduce that is make a significant change in the way that we evaluate cases from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
My opponent talks about filing cases and filing charges for which there is probable cause. Now, there's a probable cause to file multiple different types of felonies or charges. My belief, what I was taught by Ray Kimball, is that you take a look at a situation, you determine was a crime committed. Two, can you prove it beyond a reasonable doubt? And three, should you file it? And if you start taking that approach, which is you're trying to think about, can I prove this in a courtroom as opposed to simply is there probable cause? And two, what is the direction that I'm trying to take this in? How is the community bettered by what I am doing simply than just being mechanically and robotically filing charges? Then you're going to find that fewer charges are going to be filed. Let me give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
An example of a case that could be charged a number of different ways. Two individuals are working at a fast food restaurant, and they get in a scuffle, in which one person tips the baseball cap off of the other individual who they're having that disagreement with. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Now that is a battery. It's an offensive touching. Insulting or offensive touching, right?
Right.
Now, since it happened in a public place, it can be filed as an aggravated battery, which is a class 3 felony punishable from 2 to 5 years in prison. Now, anyone who looks at that would say, well, that's ridiculous. No one would file that as a felony, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in fact, that's exactly what my opponent did. And so if you look at that case and you say that's never going to end up as a felony, it should never be filed as a felony to begin with. And that what are we trying to do? We're trying to resolve the situation and make sure they don't come back again. How does a felony approach solve that? And so if you multiply that same type of thing, you know, hundreds and hundreds of times where shoplifting, because a person had a shoplifting 20 years ago, becomes a shoplifting subsequent, and therefore it can be filed as a felony.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a person's second time being caught driving without a driver's license, going to work to keep his job and feed his family. But it's the second or third time he can be charged as a felony, filing as a felony. Now, there are people who will say, you got to do that. My approach would be to say there are – only so much resources, finite amount of resources we have in the office. Aren't we better off figuring out what we want to do with those lower level crimes, get them to that place where we want to be immediately so we can take those resources, time and manpower to focus on the people who we fear, the people who are violent offenders, people who are drug dealers. And I know it's a roundabout answer to your question. I can't quantify it, mm-hmm. but I would bet that, well, counties our size tend to file around 300 to 400 felonies a year.
Mm. I think Brian Kerr would say he's following the letter of the law in his charging, but you would not buy that?
No. Well, I mean, learning to love the law is learning to love ambiguity. They say at the first day of law school. And the thing of it is that he is what he's not doing under those circumstances, and I really want to talk about my approach here.
Yeah.
What I want to be doing in my approach is determining, you know, was a crime committed? And technically crimes, you know, even the one with the two people there, technically, you know, that was a crime, although it got past a preliminary hearing and got sent up for trial, even though the judge on the record said that was the most egregious example of overcharging he'd ever seen.
You're saying that there's a level of discretion that he is kind of waving away from himself.
Well, prosecutors have prosecutorial discretion.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that is the greatest power that a prosecutor has. The prosecutor can decide whether to file charges or not, or what kind of charges should be filed. And doing that, you can really shape what you're trying to do and trying to have a particular goal in sight for a defendant. For example, again, I'm talking about individuals who are caught with addicted to drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of maybe filing a criminal charge, instead let's just get them to treatment right away and see how that works first. That's a better use of our time, because addiction is a public health problem. more than it is simply a crime problem. And if we can get fewer addicts, or you can get more addicts off the street, then you're going to have less demand for these drugs.
And Brian Kerr told me in an interview I did a couple weeks ago that he doesn't think that reducing racial disparities in the criminal justice system is part of the Knox County State's Attorney's Office's scope. I believe that you disagree with that. Can you explain why?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that, first of all, a prosecutor's oath, a prosecutor's duty is not simply to obtain convictions, but is to seek justice. I mean, that's literally the oath that you take as a prosecutor. And if, as a prosecutor, you are turning a blind eye to a criminal justice system that treats people differently based on gender, race, or class, well, that's not a just system at all. I believe that it is a duty of a prosecutor to determine whether or not outcomes, charging decisions are either intentionally, and I don't think it's intentionally happening, but I think it is very possible that unintentionally charging decisions and outcomes can be different based on factors of class, race, and gender. For example, the Register Mail did this article, this study that it was more likely that you'd have a more favorable outcome on a DUI if you had a private attorney instead of a public defender. What is that? That directly speaks to the amount of money that someone has in their pocket.
Yeah.
And so what I intend to do as a state's attorney, you know, we talk about these things, but we have no hard data, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so as a state's attorney, I intend to work with other agencies to gather and share data on charging, plea dispositions, and sentencing so we can reduce those disparities, as well as I intend to make that data available to the public to make myself accountable to the public so I am backing up my promises with actual action, let alone we can also identify really what is there a problem as opposed to relying on anecdotal evidence.
Mm. I think his position and some people's position would be they want the state's attorney or the law to be a neutral arbiter of justice, but you don't think that by totally ignoring the class, the income class, or the racial background of a defendant, that's not necessarily just in the long run. Is that
right? I think that you have to evaluate the criminal justice system. You have to evaluate the system in which you are working at all times. And you have to evaluate whether or not it is acting fairly. If you have a system that doesn't work fairly, it undermines people's confidence in its ability to get its job done. Then people will have a cynical view saying, oh, you know, that person got off because, has a lot of money, or that person, you got a hard sentence because of, of the color of his skin. It undermines our confidence in the ability to work. And so we have to evaluate it. So we have to get data on that. I also intend to try to evaluate from a data-based method of what outcomes and what dispositions work better in certain circumstances. You know, so we have people who commit crimes over and over again. I don't know, and no one knows, what works better or not. You know, does a 30-day sentence work better than a 60-day sentence? Does hardcore probation work better than other things? It would be useful to have data to establish that, so that if I want to develop a program in which it is tailored to address a particular problem, then I'll have the data to back that up to either use that in obtaining grants from the state and federal government or going to my county board to get their assistance. But we have to stop just kind of hoping that our system works and turning a blind eye to when we see problems and wishing and crossing our fingers. It's time to kind of take if these last 6 months have taught us anything, it's time to take a hard look at ourselves and see if there's a problem and not be fearful to find out whether or not we're doing our job right or wrong.
Mm. Before I let you go, is there any place that you can send people if they'd like to know more about you or get a yard sign, anything like that?
Sure. If you want to get a yard sign, you can come down to my law office at Brash and Everett at 143 East Main, or you can go to the Democratic Party headquarters at the 4L Plaza in Galesburg. If you're interested in finding more information about me, about my positions, the people who are endorsing me, and events, and the like, you can go either to probably the best place to go would be Facebook, Jeremy Carlin for Knox County State's Attorney, or you can go to the web at jeremycarlin.com. That's Carlin with a K.
All right. Thank you so much, Jeremy Carlin. Have a good day.
You too. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.